Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all today. So good to have the Whitakers with us again. Seems that we have something here in Salem they like. And we are so blessed to enjoy what they like on a weekly basis. Thank you, Megan and Brent. But it's good to have you all, and another week. And I don't know about you, but I really enjoyed the rainy days this week. I was sure we were going to get rained on a couple different days, and didn't amount to much at all. So I suppose if you're needing water, that wasn't a good thing. But for some of us who depend on the weather to get things done, it was a very nice reprieve. Although I'm sure we'll be needing it soon enough. Actually, we narrowly missed it. I mean, last night there was lightning around everywhere, it seemed like, and we ended up being in the hole. But I didn't come here this morning to talk about the weather. We have been studying in Isaiah, and we were working in chapter 28 last week. And didn't quite get through. And also, in the middle there, I was looking at some quotes from the Apostle Paul, and I sort of lost my way. And
stuck back
home. Yeah, although you may be thinking more of Wednesday night there. Although it was from Romans. We quoted from Romans. We just didn't spend a lot of time there last Sunday. It was interesting, the passage here in Isaiah 28, starting with verse 16. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste. And we noted that that particular verse is quoted in Peter, but it's also a version of it. That's 1 Peter 2:6. In Romans 9, Paul says, as it is written, behold, I lay in Zion a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed. And so I started to take that quote into sections last week and noted that this passage in Isaiah doesn't say anything about a stone of stumbling. It's a stone of foundation. And so, well, what is Paul doing here? Well, I had it written right there in my notes, and I stumbled over it or passed it. Isaiah chapter 8, which we've already read, 8:14, Isaiah says, and he shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling, and for a rock of offense to both of the houses of Israel. And so, of course, the New Testament Christians saw Jesus Christ as being a fulfillment of all these passages about the stone. And interestingly, Paul combines two different Isaiah verses when he quotes it, because the first half of it refers to the stone of stumbling as opposed to the stone of foundation, but and he who believes in him will not be disappointed is a rendition of the second half here of verse 16, which in this particular translation is he that believeth shall not make haste. And of course the whole message of the importance of trust, of believing, is very much at the heart of what Paul wants to communicate. And so here is an Old Testament passage which gives him a great proof text in to that end. But he quotes it as though it's all one verse. In fact, it's a combination of two verses. Now, don't you try that, but Paul can get by with that. So then, we were reading down through here, it seems that historically, probably the impetus for Isaiah's oracles here in this chapter revolve around the alliance which was made with the Egyptians, which he disapproved of. Kings of Judah tended to not want to rely totally on God. They looked at the realities of the world around them. They saw the Assyrian superpower gobbling up smaller kingdoms, and they wanted to find an alliance, a military alliance, that they could be a part of to give them a sense of security. So they went to Egypt, and Hezekiah was like, no, that's not going to work. That's not going to happen. And so he uses that particular topic numerous times, we've seen already in his writing. And so he says here in verse 18, your covenant with death shall be disannulled. Your agreement with hell shall not stand. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, then ye shall be trodden down by it. From the time that it goeth forth, it shall take you. For morning by morning shall it pass over, by day and by night. And it shall be a vexation only to understand the report. In other words, it'll be scary just to listen to the news. Okay, just the reports of things that are happening. And that's kind of how it developed with this particular onslaught of the Assyrians. There were numerous Judean towns, Lachish is one of the famous ones, that were besieged and taken by the Assyrians. The Assyrians avoided Jerusalem to start with and took the surrounding countryside and towns. And that would be a scary thing, you know, as you hear these reports of the enemy coming closer and closer and totally devastating whatever it is they encounter, and realizing that you don't have anything that those cities didn't have, and the likelihood of you being able to survive indefinitely a siege is more or less zero. And yet, in this particular period of time, whenever the Assyrians got to Jerusalem, God, through miraculous means, turned them away, and they left. And it was a occasion that Isaiah used to say, look, God's in control of this. You should trust him. You should trust him in the long run as well as in the small details. But in this line of thought then, it's sort of like he's suggesting to them, you've made your bed, now lie in it. In verse 20, however, the bed is shorter than a man can stretch himself on it, and the covering narrower than he can wrap himself in it, so that when he goes to scrunch up to make it inside the bed, the cover is not wide enough. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, but whenever you scrunch up, it takes more cover. Yeah. Just word to the wise. And so he says, for the Lord shall rise as in Mount Perazim. He shall be wroth as in the valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work, and bring to pass his act, his strange act. Okay, so these references that Isaiah makes here seem to be to some passages in Samuel during the time of David. And so it's often important that you situate yourself in your mind time-wise. So this is Isaiah. How many years after David approximately did Isaiah live? I mean, Isaiah seems like a long time ago, right? But David was before him. Do you know about how many years that was?
About 300.
So this invasion of Sennacherib, the Assyrian, was just before 700, maybe 701, 702, right in there. And I always sort of remember the Temple of Solomon was dedicated about 1,000. And so David was just before that, so just about 300 years then between the two. But that's quite a while. So the Psalms of David and the deeds of David are all things that Isaiah reflects on. And of course, the blessing of God on the house of David was something that he spoke of and reveled in, agonized in at times when he saw the descendants of David not truly trusting in God. And yet he looked beyond the current regimes into a time whenever God's promises with regard to David would be fulfilled. But anyway, let's take a look right quick at these passages in Samuel. In Samuel, 2 Samuel chapter 5, starting with verse 17, but when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines came up to seek David. And this wasn't to congratulate him. They were wanting to get rid of him. And David heard of it and went down to the hold. The Philistines also came and spread themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to the Philistines?" Okay, so here's another instance early in the life of David, which illustrates the beauty of his relationship with God. He wasn't presumptuous. He says, this is my problem, but it's your problem. And what should I do? What do you want me to do? He had already killed the giant, and of course that gave him quite a reputation among the Philistines. They wanted to get rid of him. But he now has this great army, and he says to God, "What shall I do? Wilt thou deliver them into mine hand?" And the Lord said unto David, "Go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into thy hand." And David came to Baal-perazim, and David smote them there and said, "The Lord hath broken forth upon mine enemies before me as the breach of waters." Okay. So I don't know where David had experienced that reality, to use that image. A lot of times when you think of that part of the world, it seems pretty dry. But sometime or another, he had seen a dam break and the waters just inundating everything in his path. And he says, that's how this has been. Therefore, he called the name of that place Baal-perazim. And there they left their images, and David and his men burned them. David wasn't known for naming things after Baal, but apparently it was a reference to the images that the Philistines left that were then destroyed. And then on another occasion in 2 Samuel 5, a few verses later, like the next verse, 22, and the Philistines came up yet again. They were slow learners. And spread themselves in the valley. And when David inquired of the Lord, the Lord said, "Thou shalt not go up, but fetch a compass behind them, and come upon them over against the mulberry trees. And let it be, when thou hearest the sound of a going in the tops of the mulberry trees, that then thou shalt bestir thyself. For then shall the Lord go out before thee to smite the host of the Philistines." And David did so, as the Lord had commanded. And he smote the Philistines from Geba until thou come to Gazer. And so, two instances of where David was very much following the direction and the leadership of the Lord. And the Lord gets the credit in these passages for defeating the enemy. And so Isaiah says it's as then, looking back to that time whenever the leadership of Judah was following God, that trusted in God, depended on God. and God undertook for them. He says it was like that, or it's going to be like that, that he does his strange work and brings it to pass. Yes?
I guess Isaiah would have had David's writings. I mean, were they hidden by that point, or would that be something that would be preserved?
We presume that he would, okay. Yes. Well, he's making references to them. At least he knew of them. Had to what extent they were oral, written, we don't know, but likely in a written form. That
detailed like that.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the interplay between Isaiah and Psalms shows us that, you know, he was familiar with those writings as well. And, of course, we realize now that the Hebrews were writing things down way before David.
It's just amazing as many wars and exiles and all of that somehow these... It's not like you could just stuff a book in your shirt. So.
Sure. Of course, at this time, there hadn't been any major exile from Judea, right? Judea is a Roman province. Judah. And so there had been a degree of continuity since the time of David there.
Just for my own putting things in place, is it right that Homer was around 900, they thought, maybe, if he even exists? I mean, it was put, or am I, I'm trying to think of about 1,700, where do the Greek philosophers?
Homer, wow, that's another guy. You Greek students that are more current on that seems like about right. I mean, the events he told about were much earlier, maybe 1,200.
Okay.
But
I'm just trying to. I'm wondering where that fits in all this. Just
yeah. Well, one thing that is coming out for years, scholars have puzzled over the origin of the Philistines. In some cases, they're referred to as sea peoples, and. Some of the recent excavations in what we would call the Gaza Strip, some of the Philistine cities there, have enabled them to more and more be able to put together. They're likely from the island of
Crete,
and so part of the Greek world. There was a period in history of the Mediterranean where it's almost like a Dark Ages there's a disintegration of towns and cities and a real vacuum. And so a lot of peoples were displaced and moved around. And
what time was that?
1200.
Okay.
Yeah.
Homer appears to have lived in the 700.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Numbers are such raw things, and I like to refresh my memory on them before I affirm things. Yes. So. Yeah, one thing, for instance, that doesn't get a lot of consideration is interaction / influence between ancient Israelites and some of the other Mediterranean cultures. But perhaps as time proceeds, we'll understand that better and realize that there was stuff going on there. Okay.
It does make you think.
Yes.
You've read, you know, some of the Odyssey or Iliad, and then you read David talking about the mighty men of valor. It's like, oh, that's what they were doing. You know, no wonder they were considered so tough. Or,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's not the exact same time frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Homer does give details, doesn't he? So, he says in verse 22, "Now therefore, be ye not mockers, lest your bands be made strong. For I have heard that the Lord God of hosts," I have heard from him, I'm sorry, "a consumption even determined upon the whole earth." Okay, so I don't know if you remember, but last week, line upon line, precept upon precept, we saw that Isaiah was criticized as being simplistic, almost childish in his suggestion that we should trust in God in this complicated world. And so I think probably this verse 22 is a reflection on that. Be not mockers. "Give ye ear and hear my voice. Hearken and hear my speech. Doth the plowman plow all day to sow? Doth he open and break the clods of his ground? When he hath made plain the face thereof, doth he not cast abroad the fitches and scatter the cumin? And cast in the principal wheat and the appointed barley and the rye in their place." Okay, so David here is familiar with the agricultural process. He describes breaking up the ground and then working out the clods until you have a smooth bed for the seed. And the emphasis from Isaiah's point of view here seems to be the purposefulness of all this effort. And it is a lot of effort. Now, fortunately, we live in a day whenever we have lived in a day where we've had access to energy. And energy changes everything, doesn't it? I took advantage yesterday afternoon of the window and the weather to till up my garden. And now we still have our frustrations, you know. Three-point hitches can be a pain. But that's a small issue, really, because if you keep things greased, it's not so bad. And once you get it in there, everything's fine. You get all the tools you need for the job. But you know, in probably under an hour, I was able to do the work that would have taken ancient man days, maybe. You know, that's nice. The powers that be in the world want to deny us of access to that kind of energy, or at least make it very expensive for us. But the advances that we have seen in our quality of life and our level of civilization have been directly linked to having access to energy. And then, of course, the technology to put it to work. But this describes doing it the hard way. The plowman, he plows all day. He opens and breaks the clods, and when he has made the face plain, he casts them abroad. Fitches are black cumin as opposed to regular cumin, and both of them are used as condiments. Perhaps some of you use them in some of your cooking, I don't know. But anyway, he describes this process of preparing the ground and then planting it. "For his God doth instruct him to discretion and doth teach him." Okay, so it's all done for a purpose. It's all done to achieve an end. It's done with care. It's done with some level of precision. And then he goes to the harvest. "For the fitches are not threshed with a threshing instrument. Neither is a cartwheel turned about upon the cumin, but they are beaten with a staff and with a rod." So in the process of harvesting different grains. You use different processes. Some of the processes which are used to separate the grain from its husk or stalks would destroy other products. You can't treat them the same way. In our day, for instance, you can take an auger and you can auger corn or beans or wheat into a truck or a trailer. But you don't want to do peaches that way. Or tomatoes, right? You better handle those differently. And so that's the kind of thing that Isaiah is pointing to here, that you handle the different products based on what they will stand, what their nature is. And he says, the bread corn is bruised because he will not be ever threshing it, nor break it with the wheel of his cart, nor bruise it with his horsemen. If you push it too hard, if you do too much of the process, even the processes that are legitimate, you destroy it. This also cometh forth from the Lord of hosts, which is wonderful in counsel and excellent in working. And he seems to be referring in this comparison to the fact that God is at work in all these things. God has decreed a judgment on the sinfulness of his people, but he has limits. Because he has purposes, because part of his purpose is not to destroy them totally, but just to punish them. He knows what he's doing. And just as the farmer knows what is required and yet what is too much, so the Lord of hosts does as well. So Isaiah is very much in touch with the real world around him and constantly reaching into it to bring out pictures that communicate his message. And it's interesting to me. I've never taken this depth of look at Isaiah before, but in seeing then how the New Testament writers read this and how that it just forms the foundation for all that they understood in looking at the life of Jesus, you realize how influential this book has been, the book of Isaiah. And you may know this, but one of the few scrolls that was recovered fully intact in the Dead Sea Scrolls was an Isaiah scroll. There were many partial copies of it, as well as other scrolls, but it was the Isaiah scroll was recovered intact and forms the basis of a museum in Israel. So it's a huge piece of literature that forms the backbone of both Jewish consciousness and Christian understanding. Okay, so that's chapter 28. Now, we started this section of chapters noting that there were how many woes in them?
It was six.
It was six, yes, it was. And one of them was here in 28. Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim. And the second one will begin chapter 29, where we have a woe to Ariel, the city where David dwelt. Add ye year to year, let them kill sacrifices. Yet I will distress Ariel, and there shall be heaviness and sorrow. and it shall be unto me as Ariel. Okay, so what's this about? Well, Isaiah chooses not to identify Jerusalem by name here, even though it's clear that's what he's referring to. Literally, the word Ariel means lion or lioness of God. See that L at the end of the word? That was one of the terms for God. And it was often the case that in the creation of names, God's name was used, as well as for pagan names. So if you see Baal somewhere in a name, that is a reference to the Canaanite god Baal. And it's interesting, during certain periods of Israelite history, Israelites were using Baal names for their kids, which tells you something, doesn't it? But here, like I say, literally, if you take the word apart, that's what it means. And yet we have this use in verse 2 where it says, "And it shall be unto me as Ariel." And I haven't found out yet how they get it, but it is translated as well as an altar hearth. The particular lexicon that I have doesn't refer to that as an option, but if you look at alternative translations, as well as the commentary I'm reading here, for instance, the NIV translates it like an altar hearth. Apparently, there's some linguistic reasons for that, and I'm sorry, I don't know what those are. Whoa. So he's prescribing woe here. He says, I will camp thee round about, and will lay siege against thee with a mount, and I will raise forts against thee. And that's a description of how these ancient cities were taken. They were surrounded by mighty walls, many feet thick, many feet tall. You might wonder, if you look at them, how in the world an ancient army would ever surmount those defenses. It's easy. You just build a ramp over them, right? Of course, you got people shooting arrows at you and throwing stones and pouring hot oil, but other than that, you just do it. That's one method. The method, of course, is to undermine them, tunnel underneath, make them collapse, get inside. And he talks about raising forts here. So you build a fort outside the wall. So one of the advantages of a wall is you're above, right? It's always nice to be shooting down on your enemies. And they have to kind of, they got to have the right trajectory to get you. But if your enemy decides to build something that's as tall as your wall, you lose that that advantage. And so these are descriptions of what it was like to be under siege. And thou shalt be brought down, and shall speak out of the ground. Thy speech shall be low out of the dust, and thy voice shall be as of one that hath a familiar spirit out of the ground, and thy speech shall whisper out of the dust. Okay. Moreover, the multitude of thy strangers shall be like small dust. Now, I'm sure that most of you ladies can immediately relate to that picture if you think about the effort it takes to keep dust off of things, small dust even. I mean, where does this stuff come from, right? And yet it's always there. It's just you turn your back for, I don't know, a couple months or a year, and And it piles on. And it seems to be ubiquitous. So to say that your strangers shall be like small dust is to say there's no escaping them. They're everywhere, right? They're going to cover things. And the multitude of the terrible ones shall be as chaff that passeth away. Yet it shall be at an instant, suddenly. Thou shalt be visited of the Lord of hosts with thunder and with earthquake and great noise, with tempest and storm and the flame of devouring fire. Okay.
It's interesting, just the difference. The ESV, I think it is, that divides that sentence differently.
Okay.
Between 5 and 6.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just the difference between passes away in like an instant, suddenly, versus it's if the sentence starts there,
uh-huh.
Suddenly you will be visited by the Lord of hosts. So you,
mm-hmm.
You know, which is it? But there's, you know, there's some discretion there.
Yes.
Translation.
And, you know, we are fortunate to live in a day where we have access to a lot of resources. And so anytime you're reading a passage and struggling to make anything of it, look at another translation. Sometimes that really helps turn light bulbs. And then you see, well, the translation I was stumped by, yeah, it's essentially saying the same thing. Now, sometimes not, but sometimes you realize that it was saying it in a way that you just weren't getting it. So that's always an interesting thing to do, and sometimes quite helpful. And so then he goes then from transitions from talking about judgment on this city to a sort of 11th hour salvation, an ultimate preservation. He says, the multitude of all the nations that fight against Ariel, even all that fight against her and her munition and that distress her, shall be as a dream of a night vision. Okay, in what way? It shall even be as when a hungry man dreameth, and behold, he eateth, but he awaketh, and his soul is empty. Or as when a thirsty man dreameth, and behold, he drinketh, but he awaketh, and behold, he is faint, and his soul hath appetite. So shall the multitude of all the nations be that fight against Mount Zion.
I'm like right there saying, in your dreams.
In your dreams, yeah. Yeah. Now, there's some dreams that you're happy to wake up from, right? I've had occasion to, I had the sensation I was trying to wake myself up. You know, this is not going well. I don't want to know where this goes. Let's wake up. But in this case, you don't want to wake up. You're getting satisfied. You're getting full. But when you wake up, you're not. And so here in verse 8, for instance, if you had any question about whether Isaiah was talking about Jerusalem, we have this clarification, they that fight against Mount Zion. So Ariel is clearly a reference to Jerusalem. Verse 9, stay yourselves and wonder, cry ye out and cry. They are drunken, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Lord hath poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and hath closed your eyes. The prophets and your rulers and the seers hath he covered. The vision of all is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, read this, I pray thee, And he saith, I cannot, for it is sealed. And the book is delivered to him that is not learned, saying, read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I am not learned. Wherefore the Lord saith, for as much as this people draw near me with their mouth, and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. Okay, so there's all sorts of echoes there. They're not echoes. They're prequels to what we see coming in the New Testament. Back up here with the sealed book, it's interesting, the image there. Now, sometime, if you find yourself studying in the book of Revelation, you should take time to note that there are almost no new images in the book of Revelation that haven't been prefigured in the Old Testament. And one of the pictures, of course, you see in the book of Revelation is the opening of seals. And so here we have a book, a scroll that is sealed. And the one that has learned says, I cannot read it because it is sealed. And we're like, well, just break the seal, right? How hard is that? They're usually wax or clay, and I mean, just do it. And it brings a couple things to mind. Now, the commentator sees this particular section as speaking of an interest or a disinterest or an unwillingness to even go to that much trouble. But I wonder, too, though, if it doesn't express something that is a little bit beyond our experience. If you have a document which is sealed with a signet of a very important person, you're probably going to be afraid to break the seal if you don't have authority, right? One of the images of the Revelation, of course, is the expression of the fact that the Lamb, you remember you had the seals that couldn't be opened. Nobody was worthy to open them. And behold, the Lamb was found worthy. And so I think that's probably a dimension that we don't encounter in our reality, that was a part of this reality, that the seal meant something. It meant that unless you're the one to whom this is pertaining, unless you have the authority to open it, you don't do that. You don't dare do that. So there's a powerful image. Then we have this conclusion of the Lord, this people draws near me with their mouth. Their lips honor me. They have removed their heart from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. And so then to sort of combine the things that Isaiah is working on here with the things we were talking about in Deuteronomy and that Paul refers to in Romans with regard to the direction that rabbinic Judaism was headed in, the direction that it took in the first century and beyond. I think that, that Paul would see in a passage like this a description of where Judaism was going. This lack of intimate relationship with God, this lack of trust relationship with God. Even their fear of God is taught by precept. They honor me with their mouth, with their lips. But in fact, they have lost their wisdom because they've lost my word. They have commandeered the very word of God and said, it's up to us to interpret, and God can't interfere.
So would this be more about the ones who are capable of reading don't have the authority to open it, and then the others just are incapable of reading? Authority isn't like, you know, in Jesus, they're like, where do you get your authority? So that, you know, that not a connection to God.
He says, the vision is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed. So, it of course is a metaphor, you know, describing the effect of the words not becoming of any use. They either can't be read, or they're refusing to be read because of this sealing. So, I think that's what you were saying.
I'm wondering if that's more, like, it wasn't because they respected the seal that they weren't going to open it and read it. It was more like
an excuse.
Yeah, like we don't have the authority to do it.
But keep in mind, that's the metaphor thing. It's as though somebody did that. In fact, the rabbis ended up saying, oh yeah, we do have the authority. In fact, God gave it to us, and he no longer can interfere with that.
But I wonder if there's maybe a little different understanding of what authority meant then than it does now. Mm-hmm. I guess, I know it's a very different time era, but when they said to Jesus, where do you get your authority? It seems more about, like, his just presumption.
Yeah. Because he didn't use the rabbinic method, right? So he wasn't looking for consensus of opinion among the top rabbis. He just says, this is how it is. He was unique and notable in that they said of him, he speaks with authority. And so then the question is, where do you get that?
Mm-hmm. He was interesting too. In verse 9, he says, blind yourselves. But then in verse 10, that God has poured a spirit of deep sleep and closed their eyes. And then back to 13, then it's these people, is what they've done to themselves, or their own condition. So you kind of have this, they've done it to themselves, God's done it to them, or it's the condition that they're in. So, you know, mm-hmm. It's easy to want to say, all right, so whose fault is it? Mm-hmm. But is it more just they're not doing this, they're not following God like they should be, and so he's not going to give them, he's not going to open their eyes to truth because they're not where they should be anyway. Is that maybe more?
Well, and two, there's the aspect of perspective. To an onlooker, it's like these people are drunk. These people can't see. These people have been affected beyond their control by the divine to be in a really weird state. And yet, Isaiah is very much intent also on showing their culpability. It is because of your choice not to trust him. Your choice to follow your own way. So, you know, it kind of depends on... the prophet has the ability to change points of view quickly, places of observing.
You see this in the New Testament with the Pharisees. I mean, they were choosing to be blind to what the prophecies were saying. They were drunk on their own authority, their own esteem. And then so God basically hardened their hearts toward Jesus, and they basically put a sleep over them. So you can kind of see the analogy here.
Yet the guy on the street's like, these are smart people. How could they be doing this, right? How's this happening? So it's part of the complications of prophetic language.
Poetic.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I would argue they're intelligent people, but not smart.
Mm-hmm.
It really reminds me of Romans 1, mm-hmm. where people choose to not see God in nature and not honor God as God, and therefore God gives them over. It's not necessarily a case of God causing these people to not be able to see. They already don't want to see. He's just allowing them not to.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like he allows the consequences that take place when you choose that. He's
giving them the opportunity to do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they truly don't want to see the Messiah. So he's not giving them any extra revelation as to
And if you ask anybody, that's okay, right? Is it okay if I let you have what you want? Yeah, I'm okay with that. You won't have them complaining to God about that. Well, I hear a feeble bell, so I'll stop there. Thank you all for your attention.
Jesus.